يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello, and welcome to another Middle East Analysis. Now, as normal, I'm joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian, an international lawyer, political commentator, and expert on the MENA region. Harry is also the consultant to the Catholic Bishops of England and Wales on the region. Harry, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thanks, James. It's nice to be back here. This is becoming a very familiar territory for me.
I'm glad. I think that's a good thing.
Well, I hope that your listeners are glad too.
Let's talk Syria. Now, obviously, since we last put a podcast out, President Bashar al-Assad has made his speech. I want to start right to the nub of it. Too little, too late?
I think it's a little bit too little, too late. At least that's the reaction on the street at the moment, James. The president gave his third speech a few days ago, and it was a catch-up on his second speech, which was on the 16th of April. And a lot of people were thinking that this would actually flesh out the vision of how to introduce those reforms. And my problem with the speech, although it did make references to constitutional amendments, it did make reference to amnesties, it did make reference to a future shape for Syria, but it was short on detail, and I think it was more of an academic analysis than it was really a political vision for the future. And I think actually that the street's imagination was not fired up sufficiently by the speech, that the riots continue, the deaths also unfortunately continue, and so much so that the foreign minister of Syria, Walid Mallim, also gave a press conference, again at the Damascus University, interesting venue, in order to try perhaps to explain a little bit what the president had said in his speech, and also to reassure some Syrians who are getting a little bit uncomfortable that the situation might be getting out of control and we don't know what the future holds in terms of reforms, in terms of the future of the ruling party, and in terms of the president's future ambitions themselves.
Any international pressure being brought to bear on the president yet?
Certainly. I think that the European Union, including our own Foreign Secretary, William Hague, have said that they have met the president's speech with disappointment. And indeed, I think it's a little bit more than disappointment, because what's happened very simply is the following. There has been so much of a credibility gap between what has been said and what has been done over the past 3 months of uprisings and riots in Syria that the people on the street are no longer ready to believe what is being promised to them today. If, as I said in one of my articles, if the president had said what he said a few days ago, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, when the riots were just beginning, then the people might have actually taken his suggestions more seriously. Now, after 3 months, with all the deaths, over 1,300 people killed, over 10,000 people arrested, the refugees who are flowing into those white camps we see on our television screens across the northern governorate into Turkey, all this has basically created a credibility gap. And what has happened is that the president is left appearing, unfortunately, as if he is chasing events rather than creating the momentum politically himself. And I think what is necessary now is to really get to grips with the security issues involved and move forward. If that happens, perhaps there is still hope that the president, who is popular in many parts of Syria, just as he's unpopular in others, would still be able to lead those reforms toward a better future. If he doesn't do that, I think power might actually be slipping away from him.
Are we going to see any more freedoms for the people, though?
Well, that is the big question. The two banners of all those uprisings across the region, James, as you and I have discussed often, are about freedom, liberty, and also dignity. And the question is, how much would the Syrian industry, those who are demonstrating either in Damascus, in Aleppo, in Homs, in other parts of the country, how much would they feel that if they were to stop protesting now and enter into some sort of national dialogue, how much would that be resulting into something concrete, into real changes on the ground? Or is it just a gimmick to tell them, come and let's talk, so that they stop demonstrating, and the minute they do that, we go back to where we are 3 months ago, which is an oppressive totalitarian system dictating to its people rather than the people having their say in the governance of their own country?
Well, talking gimmicks or potential gimmicks, let's move on now to Jordan and Morocco.
Interesting kingdoms.
Well, and the chance of constitutional reform, or possibly the promise of, will we see constitutional reform in either of those two places?
You know, James, what I've always argued when we've spoken or when I've written or been in conferences is that I wish that more of the MENA regions would look at what's happened in other countries and then actually take the lessons and apply them to their own situations. For instance, in Egypt and Tunisia, there was an initial resistance to change, and look what happened. The two presidents were toppled. In Libya, there is a war, basically, at the moment, where neither party is winning and neither party is losing, and the whole country is suffering. We have riots in Bahrain that are sporadic and quite vicious in nature. We have a lot of uncertainty in the whole region, and as far as Morocco and Jordan, two young kings, young monarchs who have been pretty much absolute monarchs for a while. And I think what is happening now is that both of them are trying slowly but surely to introduce some reforms which would begin to change the framework of their monarchies from absolute ones into constitutional monarchies. In other words, giving the government, the parliament, and the people more say and more power in the choice of the people who govern them, the policies that are applied. King Mohammed VI of Morocco basically made a speech in which he promised a radical rewriting of the constitution, which would be followed by a referendum. King Abdullah II of Jordan also introduced some promise of reform. Now, two questions arise here. One, in both of those countries, would those promises actually materialize and become real, or would they stay in the realm of the spoken and therefore will not have any impact on the people on the ground and be potentially a source of trouble? I'm hoping that both those kings would actually be brave enough to lead the way forward rather than have to chase the events the way the Syrian president unfortunately seems to be doing these days.
Morocco specifically, though, surely they're looking eastwards a little bit, and without the events in the MENA region, probably wouldn't be having this conversation at all about constitutional reform.
Well, I don't think any country in the Middle East and North Africa region would be even thinking of constitutional reforms or any other kind of reforms if there weren't the pressure that the street is applying on the government, the rulers, the people in power. I mean, let's not be too naive about this, James. Politics leads, and sometimes people have a say. And after decades of slumber, the Arab people across the Middle East and North Africa have risen up. The wall of fear has collapsed. They are out in the streets and they are now demanding the dignity that they feel they are due as ordinary citizens of the country. In other words, they are citizens. They're not just there to accept what the rulers dole out and dish out or give them. And in that sense, what is ironic in it is that once they're out in the streets and that wall of fear has collapsed, it's very difficult for them to go back into their houses without achieving anything substantial, because they would actually then be in physical danger if we go back to the system of oppression that existed before they went out in the streets.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You get this sort of, if you were to build a vision, you get this vision of some grumpy old men and slightly younger men as well in some of these cases, grudgingly giving a little bit of ground because they have to, because they want to cling on to power. But as you say, to turn that around, will it ever be enough for the people now? Is that cat so out of the bag that it's just going to never be enough for the people?
Well, that's part of what I think is the problem with the Syrian president's speech, is that he did make some concessions. I would agree with that. But those concessions today are far too little compared to the sacrifices of the people who've shed blood, who've seen how their own relatives, their own friends have been beaten, have been arrested and detained, or have fled the country into refugee camps. And therefore, what might have been an acceptable benchmark a month ago is no longer acceptable today. So in a sense, the pressure should be on, but there is also a cultural reality across the Middle East and North Africa. You don't have to rewrite the whole region, nor do you need to apply Eurocentric or European sense of democracy and freedom as we know it here, because we've had our fair share of problems, wars, bloodbaths, and therefore, this is what's happening in a miniature sense in the region. And I'm just hoping that the time will come, and it is a long haul. Remember, I told you in the previous podcast, we're in it for the long haul, that hopefully, little by little, things would change, that kings like Morocco and Jordan would move forward toward a fairer system of rule, that Egypt would not basically make a U-turn, but that it would move forward with its exercise of democracy. The same thing with Tunisia. Hopefully the Libyan nightmare will somehow come to an end, and that we in the West will learn our lessons yet again about how much we should get involved in those wars. And at the end of the day, a healthy democratic region is good for the region itself and the people of the region, but ultimately also for the peace and stability of the world.
Well, echoing those final two things you've just mentioned there moves us very nicely along to Israel-Palestine, I think. You know, talking about things that need to establish themselves peacefully in order for the whole region and world to be a more peaceful place. Should the Palestinians actually look for statehood here?
Well, it's interesting because I've often argued that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is the hub of all other issues in the region, and it still remains so. And if you talk to anybody in this whole vast region, everybody would tell you that the Israeli-Palestinian issue is an issue that is very much at the forefront of their thinking and political imagination. And in that sense, at the moment, given that there is a total impasse where we used to speak a few months ago about a peace process, because we knew that the peace was not living, but the process was living. At the moment, both the peace and the process have died. So what we are hoping for, or what the Palestinians are saying, since there's no peace and no process, we're going to go and apply for a statehood at the United Nations and become a state. I think part of that is a psychological ploy to apply pressure on Israel to negotiate with the Palestinians concretely and robustly in order to reach a two-state solution. Or alternatively, they might actually go ahead and make this bid for statehood at the UN. They might well get it if they get the majority within the General Assembly. However, the question then would be, what would be the difference the day after that bid for statehood than the night before?
Stop stealing my questions, Harry. I mean, that's the key, isn't it? What practical difference? You did mention that there might be a more political reason here, but what would it do?
Well, I'll tell you what it might do, James, and it's certainly not going to remove the checkpoints dotted across the whole West Bank. It's not going to bring down the separation wall that divides one community from another, one monastery from its school. But what it might do is that it would create a new reality on the ground, that Palestine would be a state, even if only on paper. And therefore, the relations of that new state on paper with Israel and the negotiations that will then ensue as a result of this bid of statehood bid would be different from those that are taking place now, because it would be as if two states are negotiating on an occupation, and therefore the benchmarks would be different, the international agreements might be different, so it might make a qualitative difference. But The danger of all that is that it would polarize the situation more than make it more amenable toward a win-win two-state solution. So I think the Palestinians themselves, just as a lot of the analysts, are divided on where we go with this bid for statehood. But we are now still 2-3 months before crunch time, and therefore a lot could happen in the region in those 2-3 months, as you and I know. And therefore, I think until the last minute, we won't know what will happen there and whether, critically, the European Union, in terms of its key players, Germany, Britain, France, would support this this bid or not, and what would be its consequences upon the two peoples of the region. We have an interest in it as a conference of bishops because we have a mandate to look out for the Christian communities in that part of the world, and therefore what happens to them in the sense of this universal fellowship we have as Christians would also be of importance to us.
Well, Harry, I understand you are off on your travels, so no doubt you'll be able to give us more of your expert insight when you return. That's Dr. Harry Hagopian, international lawyer, consultant to the bishops of England and Wales on the Middle East. Thank you ever so much, as always.
Thank you, James.